Welcome to a deep dive into emergency pharmacology. We've got a fascinating set of drug information sheets, the kind EMTs use every day, and we're going to break down what you really need to know about these medications.
Exactly. We'll be covering what each one does, why it's important in emergencies, and some of the finer points that can make a real difference out in the field.
Think of it like your cheat sheet for understanding these meds like a pro. And trust me, you might be surprised by some of what we uncovered today, even if you already know a thing or two about medicine.
There's always more to learn, even about drugs we think we know well.
Let's jump right in with one you probably recognize, albuterol sulfate, also known as Ventolin, that blue inhaler most people associate with asthma and breathing issues.
A classic for a reason. It's what we call a beta-2 agonist.
Beta-2 agonist. It sounds pretty technical. Can you break that down a little? What does that mean for those of us who aren't medical experts? Like, what's actually happening in the body when you use albuterol?
Well, you can imagine your airways are like tiny tubes. And when you have an asthma attack, these tubes constrict, making it hard to breathe. Albuterol, as a beta-2 agonist, essentially relaxes those muscles, sort of unlocks those constricted airways. Air can flow more freely, and you get that relief you need.
So kind of like opening a tight fist to make it easier to hold something.
Exactly. It's a great analogy. What makes it so important in emergencies is that it's super fast acting. We're talking minutes. You can see why that's critical when every second counts.
Absolutely. Now, I see here on the dosage sheet, it mentions a couple of ways to give albuterol a handheld inhaler, which is the most common, and through a nebulizer. And of course, the dosage is different for adults and children.
That's right. Adults would typically get a higher dose, somewhere between 2.5 and 5 milligrams via inhaler, or the same dose through a nebulizer. Kids, on the other hand, usually get a smaller amount, about 1.25 milligrams via inhaler or 2.5 milligrams through a nebulizer.
Interesting how the delivery method can actually affect the dosage.
It really comes down to how the medicine gets to the lungs and how it's absorbed into the bloodstream.
Now, I know any medication can have side effects. With albuterol, I know some people get a racing heart or feel a little jittery after using it.
Those are pretty common side effects, mostly because of that stimulating effect it has. Think of it like a little adrenaline rush. Usually these effects are mild and totally manageable, especially compared to the benefit of being able to breathe properly, but definitely something to be aware of.
It's always about weighing the risks and benefits, right? Especially in an emergency. All right, let's move on to another one that's often used for breathing troubles, ipratropium bromide, also known as Atrovent. It seems like this one often pairs up with albuterol, right?
They're a good team, particularly for conditions like COPD, where the airways are chronically narrowed.
I'm curious, though, how is ipratropium bromide different from albuterol? They both aim to open the airways, but is it the same mechanism?
Ah, great question. They actually work in very different ways. Remember, albuterol is a beta-2 agonist. Well, ipratropium bromide is what we call an anticholinergic.
Anticholinergic, doctor. Okay, can you need you to unpack that one for me?
No problem. To understand how they work, we need to talk about a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. It does a lot of things in the body, including, you guessed it, constricting the airways. Anticholinergics like ipratropium bromide basically block the effects of acetylcholine.
So it's like intercepting a message before it gets where it's going.
Precisely. By blocking acetylcholine, ipratropium bromide stops the airways from constricting further, which helps to keep them open and makes it easier to breathe.
So they essentially achieve the same goal, but through totally different paths. Fascinating.
Exactly. And using them together can actually have what we call a synergistic effect. They're often more effective combined than they are alone.
Now, I noticed something in the pearls section for ipratropium bromide. It mentions some confusion about soy and peanut allergies.
Oh, yes. That's a really important point for EMS providers to know. You see, the liquid formulation of ipratropium bromide might have soybean oil. However, the nebulized form, the one we use in emergencies, does not. So it's safe for patients with soy allergies as long as it's given through a nebulizer.
That's a key difference. It just goes to show that even small details can be really important in emergency medicine. Let's move on to a medication that seems to do a lot of different things. Magnesium sulfate.
Oh, magnesium sulfate is definitely a workhorse in emergency medicine. It's an electrolyte, an antiarrhythmic, a CNS depressant, and a smooth muscle relaxant all in one. Talk about multitasking.
Wow. So with all those properties, when would you actually use it in an emergency?
It steps up in some pretty serious situations. One of the main uses is to prevent and control seizures, particularly in pregnant women with a condition called eclampsia. It's also a go-to treatment for a dangerous heart rhythm called torsades de pointe, which can be life-threatening.
Sounds powerful. I'm curious, how does it actually work to create all these different effects? What's happening at a cellular level?
Well, a key mechanism is that it's a calcium channel blocker. Calcium is essential for a lot of things in the body, especially muscle contraction and nerve transmission.
So by blocking calcium, it's sort of calming things down.
Precisely. Calcium is like the spark plug that ignites muscle and nerve activity. Magnesium sulfate, by blocking those calcium channels, helps regulate that activity and keeps things from going haywire. That's why it's so effective for seizures and certain heart rhythms where there's too much electrical activity.
That's helpful. Now, looking at this dosage information, it seems like getting the dose right for magnesium sulfate is really important.
You bet. Too much magnesium sulfate can have some serious side effects, including a dangerous drop in blood pressure. That's why it's given slowly, usually through an IV, and we watch the patient's vital signs very closely the whole time.
You definitely don't want to overdo it with a medication that has that much power. Now, I'm noticing something a little paradoxical. It says here that magnesium sulfate is a CNS depressant, meaning it slows down brain activity, but it's used to control seizures. How does that work?
It might seem counterintuitive, but it's all about balance. Seizures happen because of uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain. Now, magnesium sulfate is a CNS depressant, but that calcium-blocking action we talked about actually helps to calm down those overexcited neurons. It stops them from firing too much, which halts or prevents the seizure.
So it's kind of like hitting the brakes on runaway electrical activity in the brain.
Perfect analogy.
And speaking of brakes, the pearls section for magnesium sulfate has some important reminders for EMS providers.
For sure. One thing to watch for is signs of CNS depression, like slowed breathing or decreased level of consciousness. It also mentions that giving magnesium sulfate too quickly can cause the patient's skin to flush.
So I'll be on the lookout for lobster-colored patients.
Right. And it also reminds us that if a patient is having seizures that aren't responding to magnesium sulfate, the next step is usually benzodiazepines.
Good to know. Okay, let's move on to another powerful player in the emergency medicine toolkit, methylprednisolone, better known as solumedrol. This one falls under the category of corticosteroids, right?
That's it. Solumedrol is a strong anti-inflammatory medication. Corticosteroids are amazing because they basically put the brakes on the body's immune response.
So they're like the peacekeepers, stepping in to calm things down when inflammation gets out of hand.
Exactly. Think of inflammation as the body's alarm system. It's a natural response to injury or infection, but sometimes the alarm gets stuck in the on position, and that's when it starts causing more harm than good.
So solumedrol helps to silence that alarm.
You got it. And since we can give it both intravenously and intramuscularly, it's pretty versatile for managing a bunch of different conditions and emergencies.
I see here that the dosage can change depending on how it's administered.
Absolutely. We'll always tailor the dose based on the specific condition and how severe it is.
Now, medications can have side effects. Are there any specific concerns with solumedrol, especially with its ability to suppress the immune system?
It's a good point. While super useful, solumedrol, like all corticosteroids, can have side effects, particularly if used long-term. But in an emergency, the benefits often outweigh the risks. And it's important to remember that short-term use is generally considered safe.
Right. It's all about weighing the risk and benefit, especially in a fast-paced emergency. Okay, let's shift gears to a medication that's often seen as a true lifesaver, particularly in the face of the opioid epidemic, naloxone, also known as Narcan.
Naloxone is a powerful weapon in our fight against opioid overdoses. We call it a narcotic antagonist.
Antagonist. So like it's on the opposite team of narcotics.
Exactly. It basically blocks the effects of opioids in the brain, specifically at those opioid receptors.
So it's like putting up a shield to stop the opioid from attaching and doing its thing.
You got it. In an opioid overdose where breathing slows down dangerously, naloxone is like hitting the reset button. It reverses those effects and allows the person to breathe again.
And I've heard it acts incredibly fast, which seems crucial in that kind of situation.
Absolutely. When someone's not breathing, every second matters. Naloxone kicks in within minutes, which is a big reason why it's so effective at reversing opioid overdoses.
I know there are a few ways to administer naloxone. I've seen it given intravenously, intramuscularly, and even as a nasal spray.
You're right. The way we give it depends on what's happening and what we have available. The nasal spray is becoming really popular because it's so easy to use, even for people without medical training.
The pearls section for naloxone mentions that sometimes you need to give repeated doses to keep someone breathing.
Yes, that's really important to remember. Some opioids, like fentanyl, are so strong that one dose of naloxone might not be enough to fully counter their effects. And sometimes multiple doses are needed. It's important to remember that the goal is to get them breathing again, not necessarily to make them fully conscious right away.
Right. So even if they're not completely alert after getting naloxone, if they're breathing on their own, that's a good sign.
Exactly. Breathing is priority number one in an overdose.
Okay. Let's switch gears to a medication that deals with a more common, though still unpleasant, experience. Nausea. Mm. We're talking about ondansetron hydrochloride, or Zofran. I think most people have probably encountered this one at some point.
Oh, it's definitely a familiar name. Zofran's a very effective antiemetic. It's great at preventing nausea and vomiting.
I've heard it works by blocking serotonin receptors, but can you remind me why that helps stop vomiting?
Sure. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter involved in tons of things, including regulating nausea and vomiting. It turns out that there are specific serotonin receptors in the brain and the gut that really trigger those feelings of nausea.
So ondansetron swoops in and blocks those receptors, preventing the "I need to throw up" signal.
Exactly. Think of it like cutting the communication lines between the brain and the gut, stopping that nausea signal in its tracks.
That makes sense. And I know ondansetron comes in a few different forms, making it pretty easy to use in different situations.
It does. We've got tablets, orally dissolving films, and even intravenous solutions.
The Pearl section for ondansetron mentions something about the intravenous form. It says EMS providers should give it slowly to avoid potential issues.
Right. While generally very safe, giving any medication too quickly intravenously can cause side effects. Slow and steady is best, especially when we're talking about IV meds.
Seems like that's a recurring theme in emergency pharmacology.
Absolutely. Controlled administration is key for both safety and making sure the medication works properly.
Okay, we've covered some serious stuff so far. Breathing emergencies, seizures, opioid overdoses. But this deep dive wouldn't be complete without talking about another big one. Heart attacks. And that's where aspirin comes in. Seems pretty basic, right? I mean, everyone has aspirin somewhere at home.
It might seem like an everyday medication, but aspirin is a real MVP in emergency medicine, especially when we're dealing with a possible heart attack.
So, aside from the usual pain relief, how does aspirin actually help during a heart attack? What's happening in the body?
Well, think of aspirin like a negotiator, but in the world of blood clotting, we call it an antiplatelet drug, which means it stops those tiny cells in our blood platelets from sticking together and forming clots.
Okay, and why is that so important when someone's having a heart attack?
Well, during a heart attack, a clot can form in one of the coronary arteries. Those are the blood vessels that supply oxygen-rich blood to the heart muscle itself. That clot basically blocks the blood supply, which damages the heart. Aspirin comes in and helps prevent that clot from forming or getting bigger. It keeps that crucial pathway open.
It's like that saying, time is muscle, when it comes to heart attacks. The faster we can get that blood flowing again, the less damage there'll be.
Exactly. Every minute counts. And that's why how quickly aspirin works is so important. It's usually given as a chewable tablet, so it gets absorbed into the bloodstream fast and starts working ASD.
The dosage seems pretty straightforward. A single dose of 324 milligrams, which is usually like four of those baby aspirins,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. And the pearls from experienced EMS providers remind us to always make sure the patient isn't allergic to aspirin before giving it to them.
Right. We don't want to make things worse.
Exactly. It's also important to remember aspirin's not a magic bullet. It's most effective for certain types of heart attacks. So getting a good patient history and doing a 12-lead ECG is really important for making the right call.
Right. The right tool for the right job.
Now let's switch gears to a medication that's all about giving a quick energy boost, dextrose.
Dextrose, pure sugar power. I know it's given intravenously, but when would you use it in an emergency?
It's our go-to treatment for hypoglycemia, which is when blood sugar levels get dangerously low.
Like when you feel shaky, weak, sweaty, about to pass out.
Exactly. And if it gets really bad, hypoglycemia can lead to seizures, coma, even death.
So dextrose is like an emergency recharge for the brain, giving it that fuel it needs.
That's a great way to think about it. The brain uses a lot of energy, and it needs glucose to function properly. When those glucose levels plummet, the brain can't work right, and you get those scary symptoms. Dextrose provides that glucose quickly and effectively, restoring balance and preventing some serious complications.
I see the dosage information here says that dextrose comes as a concentrated solution, either 10% or 50%. Mm. Is there a reason for those different concentrations?
There is. The higher the concentration, the faster it'll raise those blood sugar levels. But going too fast can also cause problems like fluid overload. So it's about finding the right balance based on how severe the hypoglycemia is.
The Goldilocks principle, not too fast, not too slow, just right.
Exactly. And the pearls really highlight that point. It reminds EMS providers to give dextrose slowly and to watch those blood sugar levels closely the whole time.
Because going too high can be just as bad as being too low.
Exactly. It's all about finding that sweet spot, literally.
All right, let's move on to a medication that's all about adrenaline rushes and fight-or-flight responses, epinephrine. This is something our body naturally produces, but it's also a powerful drug in emergencies, right?
You got it. Epinephrine, or adrenaline, is a true game-changer in emergency medicine. We use it for a whole bunch of life-threatening conditions, anaphylaxis, severe asthma attacks, even cardiac arrest.
Anaphylaxis, that's a serious allergic reaction where the throat closes up, airways constrict, and it's hard to breathe. I know epinephrine's the first-line treatment, but how does it actually work to reverse those effects?
Epinephrine is like a multi-tool when it comes to anaphylaxis. First, it's what we call a vasoconstrictor, meaning it narrows those blood vessels. That helps to raise blood pressure, which can plummet dangerously during anaphylaxis.
So it's like tightening up the pipes to force the blood pressure back up.
You got it. And at the same time, it's working on the respiratory system by relaxing the muscles in the airways so the person can breathe easier.
So like hitting the reset button on a severe allergic reaction?
Yeah. Perfect analogy. Now, the dosage depends on the situation, but for anaphylaxis, we typically give it as an intramuscular injection, 0.3 milligrams for adults, 0.15 milligrams for kids.
That's the dose in an EpiPen, right? The auto-injector a lot of people with severe allergies carry.
Exactly. The EpiPen's a lifesaver. Literally. It's so important for people with severe allergies to have one and know how to use it.
It's like having a personal bodyguard against anaphylaxis.
I like that. Now, the pearls for epinephrine remind us that the best place to inject it is the lateral thigh, and massaging the area helps the medication absorb faster.
Good to know. And it also highlights that epinephrine is really a temporary fix, buying time for the person to get to the hospital.
Absolutely. It stabilizes things, but doesn't address the root cause.
All right, let's move on to another medication that helps manage blood sugar. But this one works differently than dextrose. Glucagon.
Glucagon is a hormone naturally made by the pancreas, and it's key for keeping blood sugar levels in check.
I remember it helps raise blood sugar, but how? It's not like injecting sugar directly like with dextrose, right?
You're right. Glucagon's more indirect. It's like sending a message to the liver saying, hey, we need more sugar in the blood. Release those glucose stores.
So calling in the reserves.
Exactly. Glucagon makes the liver release stored glucose into the bloodstream, which effectively raises those blood sugar levels.
So when would you use glucagon instead of dextrose?
We usually use glucagon for severe hypoglycemia when someone can't take dextrose by mouth.
So if they're unconscious or having seizures from low blood sugar, glucagon could be life-saving.
Absolutely. It can be given as an intramuscular or subcutaneous injection, typically 1 milligram for adults and 0.5 milligrams for children.
Interesting that there are two ways to inject it. Is one better than the other?
They both work well. It often comes down to what's happening and what the EMS provider prefers.
The pearl section for glucagon mentions something about potential side effects.
Oh, yeah. Nausea and vomiting are fairly common after getting glucagon, so it's always good to have an emesis basin on hand, just in case.
Always be prepared. And just like epinephrine, glucagon is a temporary fix, right? It buys us time to get the person to the hospital.
Exactly. It stabilizes the situation, but doesn't fix the underlying cause of the low blood sugar.
All right, let's talk about a medication often used for sedation and anxiety relief. Midazolam, better known as Avirst. I feel like I've heard of this one used in hospitals.
You're right. It is commonly used in hospitals, but it also has a role in pre-hospital care. It's a benzodiazepine, a type of medication that has a calming effect on the central nervous system.
So they help relax and sedate.
Exactly. Midazolam works by enhancing the effects of a neurotransmitter called GABA, which has inhibitory effects on the brain. Think of it like turning down the volume on brain activity, promoting relaxation, and reducing anxiety.
Makes sense. And it looks like midazolam can be used for a lot of different things in emergency medicine, from sedation for procedures to seizure control to anxiety relief. Pretty versatile.
It is. And we can give it in a few different ways, too, intravenously, intramuscularly, even intranasally. The dosage and how we give it depends on what's going on, the patient's age and weight, and how much sedation we need.
Sounds like using midazolam safely and effectively requires a lot of careful consideration.
Sure. That's why those pearls from experienced EMS providers are so valuable. Like, they remind us that midazolam can cause respiratory depression, especially at higher doses or when combined with other sedatives.
So keeping a close eye on the patient's breathing is super important.
Absolutely. Another key thing to remember is that while midazolam kicks in quickly, its effects don't last very long, which makes it perfect for procedures or situations where we need fast but temporary sedation.
Okay, let's talk about a heart medication now, nitroglycerin, or nitro for short.
Nitroglycerin is a classic medication for dealing with chest pain, especially angina, which happens when there's reduced blood flow to the heart muscle.
So the goal is to improve that blood flow to the heart. How does it do that?
Nitroglycerin is a vasodilator. Basically, it relaxes and widens the blood vessels, making it easier for blood to flow through.
So it's like creating more space for the blood to move.
Exactly. And by widening those coronary arteries, the blood vessels that specifically feed the heart muscle, nitroglycerin increases blood flow and relieves that angina pain.
It seems like there are a few ways to give nitroglycerin. Sublingual tablets, a spray, even an IV.
That's right. The sublingual route, which means putting a tablet under the tongue, is the most common way EMS providers give it. It gets absorbed really fast through those mucous membranes under the tongue, right into the bloodstream where it can start working quickly.
The pearls for nitroglycerin have some reminders for EMS providers, especially about watching blood pressure.
Right. Nitroglycerin can make blood pressure drop, so it's crucial to check it before and after giving it.
That makes sense. You wouldn't want to give it to someone who already has low blood pressure.
Exactly. And another big no-no is giving nitroglycerin to someone who's recently taken medications for erectile dysfunction, like Viagra or Cialis.
I've heard that can be a really bad combination.
It can be deadly. So always ask about any other medications the patient might have taken recently.
Okay, good to know. We're making great progress. We've covered a lot, but we're not quite done yet.
You're doing great. Ready for a few more?
Bring it on. I'm feeling more and more like an emergency pharmacology pro with every medication we talk about. What's next?
Let's talk about a medication that's about as essential as it gets. Oxygen.
Oxygen, the breath of life. I know it's a staple in emergency medicine, but I'm interested to hear more about how it's used in those critical situations.
Oxygen is truly fundamental.
Yeah.
Our cells need it to function. And in an emergency, when we're worried someone isn't getting enough, supplemental oxygen is key.
So anytime someone's having trouble breathing, oxygen's on the table.
Pretty much. And there are different ways to deliver it, depending on how serious the situation is and what the patient needs.
We've got the nasal cannula, the non-rebreather mask, and the bag valve mask. What's the reason for all the different options?
It all comes down to how much oxygen the patient needs and how effectively we can get it to them. The nasal cannula delivers a lower concentration of oxygen, while the non-rebreather mask delivers a higher concentration. It's like a reservoir of oxygen for the patient to breathe from. And the bag valve mask, that's for patients who aren't breathing well on their own, so we can manually help them breathe.
So it's like a hierarchy of oxygen delivery. From basic support to more advanced interventions.
That's a great way to think about it. And the pearl section for oxygen really emphasizes how important it is to keep an eye on the patient's oxygen saturation levels and adjust the flow rate accordingly.
Because giving too much oxygen can be just as bad as not giving enough.
Oh, you got it.
Yeah.
It's all about getting that balance right, making sure we're optimizing oxygen levels without doing any harm.
Okay, let's talk about another medication that helps with low blood sugar. Oral glucose. It's like the edible version of dextrose, right?
That's a great way to put it. Oral glucose is a gel that contains a concentrated dose of glucose. It's sweet, easy to administer, and it works quickly to raise blood sugar levels.
So it's a good choice for someone who's conscious and can swallow, but whose blood sugar is dangerously low.
Exactly. EMS providers often carry it, and it's becoming more readily available to the public, especially for folks with diabetes who are prone to hypoglycemia.
It says here that the typical dose is one tube, which contains 15 grams of glucose.
Yep. And it's really important to remember that oral glucose should only be given to patients who are conscious and can protect their airway.
Wouldn't want them choking on it.
Exactly. The pearls also remind us to always check the expiration date on those tubes of oral glucose.
Safety first. It also says it's a good idea to have the person eat a more substantial meal once their blood sugar is stable.
Right. Oral glucose is a quick fix, but a balanced meal helps provide sustained energy and keep that blood sugar from dropping again.
All right, let's dive into the world of strong pain relievers with morphine sulfate.
Morphine is a classic opioid analgesic. It comes from the opium poppy plant and has been used for pain relief for a very long time.
Opioid. That's a word we hear a lot these days, especially with the opioid crisis. Can you remind us what exactly opioids are and how they work?
Sure. Opioids are a group of drugs that work on the central nervous system to reduce pain. They do this by binding to specific receptors in the brain and spinal cord, basically blocking pain signals.
So they change how our brain perceives pain.
Exactly. And morphine is one of the strongest opioids out there, making it very effective for moderate to severe pain.
I know it's used for lots of painful conditions, but are there specific times when morphine is particularly helpful in emergency medicine?
Morphine is a go-to for pain relief in cases like heart attacks, trauma, severe burns, basically situations where the pain can be really intense. It's important to remember that while it's effective, morphine is a strong drug that comes with potential risks.
Right. Opioid medications can have side effects like slowed breathing.
That's a major concern. Morphine can definitely slow down breathing, especially at higher doses. And there's always that risk of addiction if it's used for a long time. That's why we have to use it carefully, always thinking about both the risks and the benefits for each patient.
It's about finding that balance between pain relief and safety.
Exactly. And the PEARL section really drives that home, reminding us to start with a low dose and increase it slowly until the pain is under control. We call that titration. And we need to watch the patient's vital signs, especially their breathing, the whole time.
It sounds like a delicate balancing act.
It is. It takes careful monitoring and a deep understanding of how morphine works and what it can do.
Okay, we're getting close to the end. Just a couple more medications to go.
You're doing great. Ready to tackle sodium bicarbonate.
Sodium bicarbonate. Wait, is that like baking soda? The stuff we use in the kitchen?
You got it. It's the same thing. But it's got some surprising medical uses, too.
No way. Oh. So how does baking soda become a life-saving medication?
Well, sodium bicarbonate is what we call an alkalinizing agent. It basically increases the pH of the blood, making it more alkaline.
pH. Now that takes me back to chemistry class. Can you remind us what exactly pH is all about?
Sure. pH measures how acidic or alkaline something is. A pH of 7 is neutral, like pure water. Anything below 7 is acidic, and anything above 7 is alkaline or basic.
So sodium bicarbonate shifts the blood pH towards the alkaline side. Why is that important in an emergency?
Well, some medical conditions can cause the blood to become too acidic, and we call that acidosis. Acidosis can be really dangerous because it messes with a lot of bodily functions.
What kinds of things can cause acidosis?
Lots of things, like cardiac arrest, severe sepsis, even some types of poisoning.
So sodium bicarbonate comes in and corrects that imbalance, bringing things back to a healthy pH level.
Exactly. We can give it intravenously, and the dose depends on how severe the acidosis is. Those pearls from experienced EMS providers remind us that sodium bicarbonate should be given slowly to avoid issues like fluid overload and electrolyte imbalances.
The Goldilocks principle again. Not too fast, not too slow.
Right. And we have to keep an eye on the patient's pH levels to make sure the sodium bicarbonate is working like it should.
Never thought I'd see the day baking soda would be a star player in emergency medicine.
It's pretty cool how something so common can be so useful in medicine.
All right. What else do we have on the list?
Let's go back to the world of antiemetics and take a closer look at ondansetron, or Zofran, which we touched on a bit earlier.
Right. We talked about it as a common anti-nausea medication. I remember it blocks serotonin receptors.
Yeah.
But I'd love to hear more about how that works.
Ondansetron's a really effective antiemetic that works by blocking specific serotonin receptors in the brain and the gastrointestinal tract. These receptors are really important in triggering nausea and vomiting.
So by blocking them, ondansetron stops the signals that make us feel nauseous.
Exactly, like intercepting the message before it gets delivered.
It makes perfect sense. And ondansetron comes in several forms, which makes it pretty versatile.
It does. You've got tablets, orally disintegrating tablets, and even IV solutions.
And the PEARL section for ondansetron says that the IV form should be given slowly to avoid potential side effects.
You got it. As we've seen with other medications, how fast we give something intravenously is really important for both safety and effectiveness.
Okay, that was fascinating. What's up next?
We're in the home stretch. Let's talk about fentanyl citrate. It's been in the news a lot lately.
Fentanyl. I've definitely heard that name, usually in relation to the opioid crisis.
Fentanyl has gotten a lot of attention, and for good reason. It's a really powerful synthetic opioid. We're talking up to 100 times stronger than morphine.
Wow, 100 times stronger. That's incredible. But also concerning, given the risks we know come with opioids.
Absolutely. Fentanyl's potency is both its strength and its weakness. It's great for severe pain, but also carries a bigger risk of overdose and respiratory depression compared to other opioids.
A double-edged sword. I know it's used in hospitals. Do EMS providers use fentanyl out in the field?
We do, but very carefully. We're seeing it more and more for pre-hospital pain management, especially in trauma cases or other situations where we need strong and fast pain relief.
Why the shift towards using fentanyl in pre-hospital settings? What makes it better than morphine?
Well, one big advantage is that it kicks in much faster than morphine, providing almost instant pain relief. And it doesn't last as long, which can be helpful depending on the situation.
So it's like a quick burst of pain relief that wears off relatively quickly.
Exactly. And fentanyl gives us lots of options for how we can administer it. We've got 5E, IM, intranasal, and even transdermal.
Transdermal, so through the skin.
That's right. There's a fentanyl patch that can be used for longer-term pain management.
Wow, that is a lot of options. It sounds like fentanyl is a versatile medication, but one that requires a lot of caution.
Absolutely. The pearls for fentanyl really stress that point. It's a strong medication that needs to be used with extreme care.
And the dose needs to be very carefully adjusted, with close monitoring for any signs of trouble breathing.
Exactly. Because it's so strong, even small mistakes with the dose can have serious consequences. Sadly, that's a big part of what's fueling the opioid crisis.
It's a powerful tool that demands a lot of respect.
Well said.
Okay, we're in a home stretch of our emergency pharmacology marathon. Two more meds to go, and then we can celebrate all this new knowledge. What's next on the list?
Let's talk about a medication that's really important for managing certain types of seizures. Phenytoin.
Phenytoin. I heard the name, but can't say I know a lot about it. What makes it stand out in emergency medicine?
Phenytoin's a real workhorse for controlling seizures. It's what we call an anticonvulsant, which means it helps prevent or control seizures.
So it basically calms down those electrical storms in the brain that cause seizures.
Exactly. And it's especially helpful for those really dramatic seizures, the ones we call grand mal seizures, and also for a very dangerous condition called status epilepticus.
Status epilepticus. That sounds serious. What is that exactly?
It's a life-threatening situation. Basically, the person has prolonged seizures or they have repeated seizures without regaining consciousness in between. It's a true medical emergency.
So phenytoin can be really important in those cases, stopping the seizures and potentially preventing brain damage.
Absolutely. It's usually given intravenously in an emergency, but it can also be given orally for long-term seizure management.
Looking at the dosage information here, it seems like the amount of phenytoin you give can vary quite a bit depending on what's going on.
That's right. The dose is really tailored to each individual patient, taking into account their age, weight, and how severe their seizures are. And those pearls from experienced EMS providers highlight some important things to think about when giving phenytoin.
What kind of things?
Well, one thing is that phenytoin has to be given slowly. Otherwise, you risk some potential heart-related side effects.
That seems to be a recurring theme. Slow and steady wins the race.
Exactly. Another important thing is that phenytoin can be a bit picky when it comes to mixing with other medications or solutions. So it's really important to flush the IV line thoroughly before and after giving it.
Okay, those are good things to know. All right, we've made it to our final medication, activated charcoal. This one's always been a bit of a mystery to me. I know it's used for poisoning, but how does it actually work?
Activated charcoal is kind of like a superpower in toxicology. It's this fine black powder that's amazing at binding to toxins in the stomach and intestines.
Bind to toxins. What does that mean exactly?
Imagine activated charcoal like a super tiny porous sponge. It's got a huge surface area, and all those tiny pores are perfect for trapping toxins. So when someone swallows a poison, activated charcoal can grab onto those toxins, stopping them from getting absorbed into the bloodstream.
So it's like a safety net, preventing the poison from getting into the body and causing more harm.
That's a great way to think about it. And it works best when given soon after the poisoning happens.
So time is of the essence.
Absolutely. The sooner we get it in there, the better it can work to bind those toxins. Now, the pearls section for activated charcoal reminds us that it's not a cure-all. It only works for certain types of poisoning.
What kinds of poisons does activated charcoal work best for?
It's great for a lot of medications and some chemicals, but it doesn't work so well for poisonings with alcohols, acids, or alkalis.
So you have to know which poisons it can handle and which ones it can't.
Exactly. And there are times when we shouldn't give activated charcoal at all. Like if someone's unconscious or having trouble breathing, there's a risk the charcoal could get into the lungs, which is a very bad situation.
Right. So it's all about using the right tool for the job. Well, we did it. We made it through our entire list of emergency medications. What a journey.
You did a fantastic job. Your curiosity and enthusiasm made this deep dive really enjoyable.
I feel like I learned so much. It's amazing how much information is packed into these drug sheets. It's inspiring to think about how these medications are used to help people, especially in those critical moments.
Absolutely. They're powerful tools, and knowing how they work and when to use them is crucial for providing safe and effective care.
I was especially struck by those pearls of wisdom we talked about along the way.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much practical knowledge and experience those tips from experienced EMS providers contain.
They're like those real-world insights you don't always find in textbooks.
So, as we wrap up this epic deep dive, what's the most important message you want our listeners to take away?
Emergency medicine is always changing. New medications, guidelines, best practices, they're always coming out. It's so important for healthcare providers to stay curious, keep learning, and always work to give their patients the best possible care.
Knowledge is power, especially when it comes to saving lives.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
A huge thank you to our expert for guiding us through this incredible exploration of emergency pharmacology. And to our listeners, we hope you found this deep dive informative and interesting. Remember, stay curious, keep learning, and until next time, stay safe.